and where this movement is headed. The greatest challenge to the plantation mentality of the media giants is the innovation and expression made possible by the digital revolution. I may still prefer the newspaper for its investigative journalism and in-depth analysis, but we now have it in our means to tell a different story from big media, our story. The other story of America that says free speech is not just corporate speech, that news is not just what officials tell us. We're not just chattel in the fields living the boss man's story. This is the great gift of the digital revolution, and you must never, never let them take it away from you. The internet, cell phones, and digital cameras that can transmit images over the internet makes possible a nation of storytellers, every citizen a Tom Paine. Let the man in the big house on Pennsylvania Avenue think that over, and the woman of the house on Capitol Hill. And the media moguls in their chalets at Sun Valley gathered to review the plantation's assets and multiply them, nail it to their door. They no longer own the copyright to America's story. It's not a top-down story anymore. Other folks are going to write this story from the ground up, and the truth will be out that the media plantation, like the cotton plantation of old, is not divinely sanctioned. It's not the product of natural forces. The media system we've been living under for a long time now was created behind closed doors where the power brokers met to divvy up the spoils. Bob McChesney has eloquently reminded us through the years how each medium, radio, television, and cable, was hailed as a technology that would give us greater diversity of voices, serious news, local programs, and lots of public service for the community. In each case, the advertisers took over. Despite what I teasingly told you the last time we were together in St. Louis, the star that shined so brightly in the firmament the year I was born, 1934, did not, I regret to say, appear over that little house in Hugo, Oklahoma. It appeared over Washington when Congress enacted the 1934 Communications Act. 100 times in that cornerstone of our communications policy, you will read the phrase public obligate interest, convenience, and necessity. I can't tell you, reading about those days, educators, union officials, religious leaders, parents were galvanized by the promise of radio as a classroom for the air, serving the life of the country and the life of the mind, until the government cut a deal with the industry to make sure nothing would threaten the already vested interests of powerful radio networks and the advertising industry. And soon, the public largely forgot about radio's promise as we accepted the entertainment produced and controlled by Jell-O, Maxwell House, and Camel cigarettes. What happened to radio happened to television, and then it happened to cable. And if we are not diligent, it will happen to the internet. Powerful forces are at work now, determined to create our media future for the benefit of the plantation. Investors, advertisers, owners, and the parasites who depend on their indulgence, including many in the governing class. Old media acquire new media and vice versa. Rupert Murdoch, forever savvy about the next key outlet that will attract eyeballs, purchased MySpace, spending nearly $600 million so he could, in the language of Wall Street, monetize those eyeballs. Google became a partner in Time Warner, investing $1 billion in its AOL online service. And now Google has bought YouTube so it would have a better vehicle for delivering interactive ads for Madison Avenue. Viacom, Microsoft, large ad agencies, and others have been buying up key media properties, many of them the leading online sites, with the result that will be a thoroughly commercialized environment, a media plantation for the 21st century dominated by the same corporate and ideological forces that have produced the system we have lived under the last 50 years. So, what do we do? Well, you've shown us what we have to do, and twice now you have shown us what we can do. 4 years ago, when FCC Commissioner Michael Powell and his ideological sidekicks decided it was okay for a single corporation to own a community's major newspaper, three of its TV stations, eight radio stations, its cable TV system, and its major broadband internet provider, you said enough's enough. Free press, Common Cause, Consumers Union, Media Access Project, the National Association of Hispanic Journalists, and others working closely with Commissioners Edelstein and Copps, two of the most public-spirited members of that commission ever to sit there. You organized public hearings across the country where people spoke up deeply felt opinions about how poorly the media was serving their towns. You flooded Congress with petitions, and you never let up. And when the court said Powell had to back off for then, the decision cited the importance of involving the public in these media decisions. Incidentally, Powell not only backed off, he backed out. He left the commission to become senior advisor at a private investment firm specializing in equity investments in media companies around the world. And that firm, by the way, made a bid to take over both Tribune and Clear Channel, two media companies that just a short time ago were under the corporate-friendly purview of, you guessed it, Michael Powell. That whishing sound you hear is Washington's perpetually revolving door through which they come to serve the public, and through which they leave to join the plantation. You made a difference. You showed the public cares about media and democracy. You turned a little publicized vote, little publicized because big media didn't want the people to know, a little publicized and seemingly arcane regulation into a big political fight and a public debate. Now, it's true, as Commissioner Copps has reminded us, that since that battle 3 years ago, there have been more than 3,300 TV and radio stations that have had their assignment and transfer grants approved. So that even under the old rules, consolidation grows, localism suffers, and diversity dwindles. It's also true that even as we speak, Michael Powell's successor, Kevin Martin, put there by George W. Bush, is ready to take up where Powell left off and give the green light to more conglomeration. Get ready to fight. But then you did it again more recently. You lit a fire under people to put Washington on notice that it had to guarantee the Internet's First Amendment protection in the $85 billion merger of AT&T and Bell South. Because of you, the so-called Internet neutrality, I much prefer to call it the equal access provision of the Internet. Neutrality makes me think of Switzerland. The equal access provision became a public issue that once again reminded the powers that be that people want the media to foster democracy, not to quench it. This is crucial. This is crucial because in a few years, virtually all media will be delivered by high-speed broadband. And without equality of access, the net could become just like cable television, where the provider decides what you see and what you pay. After all, the Bush Department of Justice had blessed the deal last October without a single condition or statement of concern. But they hadn't reckoned with Michael Copps and Jonathan Edelstein, and they hadn't reckoned with this movement. Free Press and SaveTheInternet.com orchestrated 800 organizations, 1.5 million petitions, countless local events, legions of homemade videos, smart collaboration with allies in industry, and a top-shelf communications campaign. Who would have imagined that sitting together in the same Democratic broadband pew would be the Christian Coalition, Gun Owners of America, Common Cause, and MoveOn.org? Who would have imagined that these would link arms with some of the powerful new media companies to fight for the Internet's First Amendment? We owe a tip of the hat, of course, to Republican Commissioner Robert McDowell. Despite what must have been a great deal of pressure from his side, he did the honorable thing and recused himself from the proceedings because of a conflict of interest. He might well have heard the roar of the public that you helped to create. So AT&T had to cry uncle to Copps and Edelstein with a, quote, voluntary commitment to honor equal access for at least 2 years. The agreement marks the first time that the federal government has imposed true neutrality, oops, equality, on an Internet access provider since the debate erupted almost 2 years ago. I believe you changed the terms of the debate. It is no longer about whether equality of access will govern the future of the Internet. It's about when and how. It also signals a change from defense to offense for the backers of an open net. Arguably, the biggest, most effective online organizing campaign ever conducted on a media issue can now turn to passing good laws rather than always having to fight to block bad ones. Just this week, Senator Byron Dorgan, a Democrat, and Senator Olympia Snowe, a Republican, introduced the Internet Freedom Preservation Act of 2007 to require fair and equitable access to all content. And over in the House, that champion of the public interest, Ed Markey, is once again standing there waiting to press the battle. But a caveat here, those other folks don't give up so easy. Remember, this agreement is only for 2 years, and they'll be back with all the lobbyist money can hire. As the Washington Post follows George Bush into the black hole of Baghdad, the press in Washington won't be covering many stories like this because of priorities. Furthermore, caveat, consider what AT&T got in the bargain. For giving up on neutrality, it got the green light from government to dominate over 67 million phone lines in 22 states, almost 12 million broadband users, and total control over Singular Wireless, the country's largest mobile phone company, with 58 million cell phone users. It's as if China swallowed India. I bring this up for a reason. Big media is ravenous. It never gets enough, always wants more, and it will stop at nothing to get it. These conglomerates are an empire, and they are imperial. Last week on his website, mediachannel.org, Danny Schechter recalled how some years ago he marched with a band of media activists to the headquarters of all the big media companies concentrated in the Times Square area. Their formidable buildings, fronted with logos and limos and guarded by rent-a-cops, projected their power and prestige. Danny and his cohorts chanted and held up signs calling for honest news and an end to exploitative programming. They called for diversity and access for more perspectives. It felt good, Danny said, but it seemed like a fool's errand. We were ignored, patronized, and marginalized. We couldn't shake their edifices or influence their holy business models. We seemed to many like that lonely and forlorn nut in a New Yorker cartoon carrying an end of the world is near placard. Well, yes, my friends, that is exactly how they want you to feel. As if media and democracy is a fool's errand. To his credit, Danny didn't give up. He's never given up. Neither have some of the earlier pioneers in this movement, Andy Schwartzman, Don Hazen, Jeff Chester. I confess that I came very close not to making this speech today. In favor of just getting up here and reading from this book, Digital Destiny, by my friend and co-conspirator, Jeff Chester. Take my word for it. Make this your Bible until McChesney's new book comes out. As Don Hazen writes in his review on Alternet this week, it's a terrific book, a respectful, loving, fresh, intimate conversation, comprehensive history of the struggles for a democratic media, the lost fights, the opportunities missed, and the small victories that have kept the corporate media system from having complete carte blanche over the communications channels. It's also a terrifying book because Jeff describes how we are being shadowed online by a slew of software digital gumshoes working for Madison Avenue. Our movements in cyberspace are closely tracked and analyzed, and interactive advertising infiltrates our unconsciousness to promote the brand washing of America. Jeff asked the hard questions. How do we really want television? Do we really want television sets that monitor what we watch? Or an internet that knows what sites we visit and reports back to advertising companies? Do we really want a media system designed mainly for Madison Avenue? But this is a hopeful book. After scaring the bejeepers out of us, as one reviewer wrote, Jeff offers a policy agenda for the broadband era. Here's a man who practices what the Italian philosopher Gramsci called the pessimism of the intellect and the optimism of the will. He sees the world as it is without rose-colored glasses and tries to change it despite what he knows. So you'll find here, the core of the movement's mission. You'll agree with much and disagree with some, but that's what a reform movement is about. Media reform, yes. But the Project in Excellence concluded in its State of the Media report for 2006, quote, "At many old media companies, though not at all, the decades-long battle at the top between idealists and accountants is now over. The idealists have lost. The commercial networks are lost, too, lost to silliness, farce, cowardice, and ideology. Not much hope there. You can't raise the dead. Policy reform, yes. But, says Jeff, we will likely see more consolidation of ownership with newspaper, TV stations, and major online properties in fewer hands. So he says we have to find other ways to ensure the public has access to diverse, independent, and credible sources of information. That means going to the market to find support for stronger independent media. Michael Moore and others have proven that progressivism doesn't have to equal penury. It means helping protect news gathering from predatory forces. It means fighting for more participatory media, hospitable to a full range of expression. It means building on Lawrence Lessig's notion of the creative common and Brewster Kahle's Internet Archives with his philosophy of universal access to all knowledge. It means bringing broadband service to those many millions of Americans too poor to participate so far in the digital revolution. It means ownership and participation for people of color and women. And let me tell you, it means reclaiming public broadcasting and restoring it to its original, feisty, robust, fearless mission as an alternative to the dominant media, offering journalism you can't afford and can trust, public affairs of which you're a part, and a wide range of civic and cultural discourse that leaves no one out. You can have an impact here. For one thing, we need to remind people that the federal commitment to public broadcasting in this country is about $1.50 per capita compared to $28 to $85 per capita in other democracies. Meanwhile, be vigilant about the congressional rewrite of the Telecommunications Act that is beginning as we speak. Track it day by day and post what you learn far and wide, because the decisions made in this session of Congress will affect the future of all media, corporate and non-commercial, and if we lose the future now, we'll never get it back. So you have your work cut out for you. I'm glad you're all younger than me and up to it. I'm glad so many funders are here, because while an army may move on its stomach, this movement requires hard, cold cash to compete with big media in getting the attention of Congress and the people. I'll keep an eye on your work. You are to America what the abolition movement was, and the suffragette movement, and the civil rights movement. You touch the soul of democracy. It's not assured you'll succeed in this fight. The armies of the Lord are up against mighty hosts. But as the spiritual sojourner Thomas Merton wrote to an activist grown weary and discouraged protesting the Vietnam War, "Do not depend on the hope of results. Concentrate on the value and the truth of the work itself." And in case you do get lonely, I'll leave you with this. As my plane was circling Memphis the other day, I looked out across those vast miles of fertile soil that once were plantations watered by the Mississippi River and the sweat from the brow of countless men and women who've been forced to live somebody else's story. I thought about how in time, with a lot of martyrs, they rose up, one here, then two, then many, forging a great movement that awakened America's conscience and brought us closer to the elusive but beautiful promise of the Declaration of Independence. As we made our last approach, the words of a Marge Piercy poem began to form in my head, and I remembered all over again why I was coming and why you were here. What can they do to you? Whatever they want. They can set you up. They can bust you. They can break your fingers. They can burn your brain with electricity. Blur you with drugs till you can't walk, can't remember. They can take your child, wall up your lover. They can do anything you can't blame them from doing. How can you stop them? Alone, you can fight and you can refuse. You can take what revenge you can, but they roll over you. But two people fighting back to back can cut through a mob. A snake dancing file can break a cordon. An army can meet an army. Two people can keep each other sane, can give support, conviction, love, massage, hope, sex. Three people are a delegation, a committee, a wedge. With four, you can play bridge and start an organization. With six, you can rent a whole house, eat pie for dinner with no seconds, and hold a fundraising party. A dozen make a demonstration. 100 fill a hall. 1,000 have solidarity and your own newsletter. 10,000 power and your own paper. 100,000 your own media. 10 million your own country. It goes on one at a time. It starts when you care to act. It starts when you do it again after they said no. It starts when you say we and know who you mean, and each day you mean one more. Thank you.
You were just listening to Bill Moyers on media reform. This classic from the AR archives was recorded in Memphis, Tennessee at the National Conference for Media Reform in 2007. Bill Moyers was a renowned journalist and commentator and the host and producer of many of PBS's most heralded programs. He was the winner of more than 30 Emmy Awards. Bill Moyers died in June 2025. This program is produced by Alternative Radio. We're an independent nonprofit in our 40th year. We're supported solely by individuals just like you. We feature such voices as Claudia de la Cruz, Chris Hedges, Winona LaDuke, Bob McChesney, Heather Cox Richardson, Vijay Prashad, and Arundhati Roy. To access our complete audio and book catalog, just go to our website, alternativeradio.org. Again, our website where we are podcasting, alternativeradio.org. For copies of today's program, Bill Moyers on Media Reform, and for the Howard Zinn classic book, The Indispensable Zinn, call us 1-800-444-1977 or online our website, alternativeradio.org. Again, that's alternativeradio.org. Printed transcripts, PDFs, and MP3s of this program are free of charge. To get them, just call us 1-800-444-1977. Joe Ritchie is our general manager and editor. I'm David Barsamyan. Thank you for listening. We go out with Miles Davis, I Could Write a Book. Thank you.
KGSF 90.1 FM, broadcasting from Burnaby, BC.
This is Bird Note. Gettysburg, Antietam, Monocacy. They each hold significance in American history as the sites of decisive battles in the Civil War. But these iconic battlefields have significance for birds, too, as detailed in this letter home from a grasshopper sparrow.
Dear Ma, the grasslands of my forebears are lost to time. Habitat loss has chipped away at our territories until it seems like there is nothing left. Our only refuge is in the historic National Battlefield Parks.
Okay, so birds aren't sending messages to their families from the front lines. But National Battlefield Parks are grassland habitats worth writing home about. Tall, grassy fields aren't typically considered beautiful, much less valuable to conserve. Battlefield parks are maintained as historic sites, with the side effect of preserving excellent habitat. Most of the parks are sites of Civil War battles in the eastern U.S., but there are four from the Revolutionary War and a handful of others as far off as Michigan and Montana. Today, rather than the roar of cannons, fields like Antietam are filled with the songs of blue grosbeaks. Eastern meadowlarks. And, of course, grasshopper sparrows. For our grassland birds, these too are hallowed grounds. For Bird Note, I'm Michael Stein.
Listen to Scream Therapy, a show about the link between punk rock and mental health, hosted by me, Jason Schurz. I've been part of the music scene for more than 30 years. I was diagnosed with bipolar disorder, and my whole life was thrown sideways. As part of my recovery, I've slowly returned to the music that I love. Join me and my resilient guests for no-holds-barred conversations right here on CJSF 90.1 FM, Simon Fraser University, Thursdays at 12:30 a.m. And until then, take care and be well.
No matter your disability, you likely face barriers in your everyday life. At Neil Squire, we help break those barriers down by helping you access employment, technology, and the tools you need to live your life to the fullest. As a nonprofit organization, we empower people with disabilities all across Canada, and we are here for you too. Visit neilsquire.ca to learn more.